My guest on Great Lives this week is a politician, the former Conservative Prime Minister Sir John Major. He has chosen as his subject a poet, Rudyard Kipling. Kipling was an intensely political poet who loathed politicians. "There is nothing lower," he wrote, "than an English politician in peace, except the same animal in war." Sir John, as an English politician who's been in power both in war and in peace, why such an apparently masochistic choice of Great Life?
Well, despite that view, he's a master wordsmith, a wonderful poet, an extraordinary complex personality with a huge range of writing. All that I found very attractive. He's also, despite having the reputation of being an arch conservative and imperialist, a man of many contradictions. Here's a man, in many ways, essentially from the establishment. His cousin became prime minister, and yet he refused all honours, including the offer of becoming poet laureate. He's a man who had a very remarkable life, but lived within it. He was an observer of life rather than being part of it.
And what about his remarks on cricket? Flannelled fools at the wicket. How can a cricket lover like you propose?
Well, it was a very foolish remark of his, but he was no sportsman. He's a man with much to be said for him and some things to be said against him. I think that may be said against him, but nothing, I think, can deny the genius or the scope of his writing.
With us as our expert witness is one of Kipling's biographers, Andrew Lycett. I suppose it's fair to say there are two problems that consistently attach themselves to his name. The first is the obvious one, the perhaps stereotype of him as a Victorian, Edwardian, imperialist, his apparently patronising attitude to other races, the impression you get of misogyny, all that land of hope and glory stuff as well. And the second is the poetry. It's almost too accessible. Some would say pat or trite. But you found him for his talents worthy of a massive biography.
Indeed. I started off being interested in him as a journalist. The fact that he was born and largely brought up in India was something that appealed to me. And as far as his talents as a writer are concerned, I think that his genius for observing not just the sort of environment around him, but characters, came from his experience working for the Civil and Military Gazette in Lahore. And the experience that he brought from his time in India was very attractive as far as I was concerned.
How do you respond, Sir John, firstly to the charge of jingoism and imperialism?
Well, I think a great deal of it is wrong. There were elements of what he wrote that was jingoist. I think there's absolutely no doubt about that. But I can't think of another poet who spoke so vividly for the ordinary soldier. I can't think of another poet who was prepared to attack governments for their warlike attitudes quite as much as he was. Here was a man recording his own experience in the most magical prose and rhyme. And I think that is almost unique. The argument that some of his writing is pat, I suppose, is an argument put by people who object to the fact that his poetry rhymes. Well, I don't. It not only rhymes, it has a pace, it has a speed, and it tells a story. You don't, at the end of a Kipling poem, have to scratch your head and say to yourself, I wonder what he meant by that.
One of the things that troubles me emerging from his work, and I'm surprised it doesn't trouble you because it isn't your reputation at all, is how much he hated. He hated all sorts of things. He hated Germans, he hated Boers, he hated the Irish, he hated educated Indians, he hated socialists, aesthetes, men with long hair, votes for women, liberalism, trade unions, free trade, democracy and bungalows. He spent his life raging against things. Well, you're not that kind of person.
No. Well, he was often angry. I mean, even as a boy, when he first came to England and stayed with his aunt, as a two-year-old, he would rush around saying, there's an angry ruddy coming. So I think he was angry. He saw things and he was angry about them. I don't find that offensive. Now, in some cases, he was spectacularly wrong when you stand him against the light of history.
The anger of the boy perhaps has something to do with the circumstances of his birth and upbringing, and I'd like to ask you about that, Andrew, because I'd always imagined before I started for this programme, learning a bit about Kipling, that he'd had a kind of comfortable, easy, Victorian childhood, well-heeled and all the rest, but it wasn't like that, was it?
He was born in Bombay, and at an early age he was shipped back to England with his parents, and he thought that he was going to go back to the idyllic life that he had been living in India, which he loved. But instead he was sent off to the care of foster parents in Southsea, next to Portsmouth. And he loathed that. He felt abandoned.
People his parents didn't even know. Why did they do that? Why he had relations? Why put them in the care of...
You know, it was something that rankled with him throughout his life. I mean, he wrote a very powerful story, Barbar Black Sheep, about the horror that he felt being left there. And there's a very telling story about his mother, who had been alerted to his unhappiness by his aunt. And she came back to see what was happening to her son, Rudyard. She went into his bedroom and he sort of woke up and instinctively put up his arm to fend off a blow against him, because that was what he had learnt was going to happen to him when his foster mother, his so-called auntie, came into the room.
His education seems to have been quite a mess, really.
Well, he left school at 16. He didn't go to university. He didn't even go to the sixth form.
Do you think that it rankled with him that he'd never been to university?
There is a letter he wrote when he was actually a young reporter in India, when he wrote to one of his aunts, I think it was Aunt Georgiana, saying that he would have been better off in the sixth form at Harrow. So I think it must have done.
Did it ever rankle with you that you'd never been to university?
Not when I was young, no, it didn't. Because the experiences I had were experiences I couldn't have repeated had I gone to university. I wouldn't have gone to Nigeria. I wouldn't have learned so much about how people live in places like Brixton. I would have lost those experiences, and I found them very useful later, so no, it didn't. As I have got older, I've regretted the fact that I didn't have 3 years at university in which you had time to read as widely as you would wish, and to study in depth the subjects that interest you.
At what point, Andrew, how did it come about that he's a young newspaper reporter in India?
His father was an interesting character in that he was trained as an architectural sculptor, and he was working in India doing designs to buildings such as the railway station in Bombay. He couldn't afford to send his son Rudyard to university, so he arranged with somebody that he knew, George Allen, interesting Anglo-Indian entrepreneur who had fingers in a lot of pies. He ran all sorts of businesses, but he also ran newspapers, and he ran something called The Pioneer. And Lockwood Kipling, Kipling's father, had done articles for this. And George Allen also had a paper in Lahore called The Civil and Military Gazette, which he arranged for his young son, Rudyard, to come and take a job on after he left his curious school, which is called the United Services College, out in the far west of England, in Westward Ho, near
Bidford. Sounds a bit military.
It was a sort of place that was churning out...
It was a down-market crammer.
Yes, it sounds
people
like
for,
it.
For...
And he ran a newspaper there before he went off to... I think Andrew will correct me if I'm wrong, but before he went back to India, he ran a newspaper there. But he also picked up lots of his stories. The Storky stories come from his experience at the United Services College.
It's interesting that when Kipling left school, he was actually claimed to be a liberal. He was asked in a family Gladstone. Questionnaire who was his favourite politician, and he said Gladstone. And he arrived in Lahore, and he'd come out of this almost sort of reacting against the United Services College. His friends there put up aesthetic hangings and things like that in their study at the United Services College. Yeah, and it was when Kipling arrived in Lahore, which was then part of British India, and became surrounded by these Anglo-Indians who were in this frontier province of the Punjab, that his attitudes began to change. And this was reinforced when he started going to the Punjab Club. He started meeting these people who were coming back from outstations, from jobs as engineers on the river Sutlej. And he started beginning to admire the qualities that they brought to their work, their dedication. And this was the beginnings of his great admiration for people who did things.
But this admiration wasn't extended universally towards all the British Raj, was he? He was quite critical.
Not at all. He was very critical of some, and rightly so. And he certainly didn't keep his criticism to himself. But he admired many of them, and I think for a very sound reason. The Anglo-Indians, by which I mean the British expatriates working in India, both as administrators and as soldiers, were often treated rather as second-class administrators or second-class servicemen by those back in the United Kingdom. And I think Kipling saw what they did in the most difficult circumstances and greatly admired it, and I think that is why he supported them. There are poems in which he talks about the sacrifice they made. There's one about a young soldier, £2,000 worth of education, shot like a rabbit in a ride in a dark defile. Well, that was the experience of people working in very tough parts of India, often in the northwest frontier, now Pakistan. And he greatly admired that when compared to those people who sat softly at home, critical, but not understanding.
An interesting thing about Kipling at that stage, even though he was becoming this admirer of the Anglo-Indians and the Raj, he was the sort of observer who was prepared to poke fun at characters, and you get that in his early poems. And then, of course, the Plain Tales from the Hills, which started as stories to fill the Civil and Military Gazette. And he was lambasting, he was satirising the sexual mores, to a large extent, of the people who came up to Shimla in the hot season, the way that they disported themselves and the affairs that they had and the way that women would carry on when their husbands were down in the plains sort of doing administrative work. He was very cutting about that.
Was he a bit of a prig at this stage, do you think?
I had not thought of him as that. I had thought of him more as an observer than a prig, but I suppose you could make that charge and probably make it stick, yes.
At what point does this rather angry and in some ways rebellious and not entirely happy young man, whose only expressed political preference has been for the Liberal Party, turn into the sort of conservative political poet that he became?
Quite early.
Well, I think that you could actually take it back to India, where, taking a sort of cue from his father, he was not in favour of educating the Indians. One of the stock characters of fun in his stories is the educated Babu. And you get instances of him taking against the emerging Indian Congress.
You've both spoken about his impatience with people who postured and were pompous, and his admiration for people who did things. And nowhere is this truer than his, at that time, quite unexpected and unfashionable admiration for the ordinary British soldier. Tommy, for instance, a favourite of yours, I think, Sir John.
It is. I think it's a wonderful poem. I mean, he had many poems, not just Tommy. There was Tommy Atkins, of course. That's where the expression for a British soldier being Tommy Atkins comes from. There were several later as well about how badly soldiers were treated after they had left the service and were then back in England delivering letters for a shilling a day. So it was a consistent theme. But Tommy is a lovely poem. It is indeed one of my favourites. Perhaps I can read one stanza of it. It's very pointed, delivered in the voice of a British soldier. We aren't no thin red heroes, nor we aren't no blackguards too, but single men in barracks, most remarkable like you. And if sometimes our conduct isn't all your fancy paints, why, single men in barracks don't grow into plaster saints. While it's Tommy this and Tommy that and Tommy fall behind, but it's pleased to walk in front, sir, when there's trouble in the wind. There's trouble in the wind, my boys, there's trouble in the wind. Oh, it's pleased to walk in front, sir, when there's trouble in the wind. And it's a very sharp point that the army can be ignored, but then is lionised when there is some fighting to be done. And that was very much a habit in the 19th century. I think one could argue the 18th century as well. And it hasn't quite disappeared even today.
George Orwell thought he patronised the British soldier and characterised him as a slightly comical character. Is that fair?
No, it isn't fair. I mean, someone who patronised the British soldier wouldn't have written The Absent-Minded Beggar to help raise huge funds for the families of soldiers left behind when they were at war. I think Kipling's admiration and affection for the ordinary soldier was genuine.
He was, in a sense, a ventriloquist all his life. He gave everything a voice. He gave animals and stones a voice. He gave trees a voice. He gave the ordinary British soldier a voice. He actually wants to give things their own voice. He has a great appreciation for diversity.
Well, he does it in two ways. I mean, the Jungle Book stories, and then his stories of Rikki Tikki Tavi, which were always favourites of mine because he killed snakes. Mm-hmm. And they were a great phobia of mine when I was a small boy. So I love those stories. But the whole of the Jungle Book stories lived then, and they live now. And then later, there are the Just So stories. And some of them are very moving. that he writes later on, after his daughter has died.
Here, too, we come back to the contradictions that you've spoken about, because there's a tenderness in these stories. There's a tenderness in the voice of the author, and it contrasts so strangely with the stridency and haranguing that also characterised quite a lot of his work.
He wrote about there being two sides to his brain.
He put it down to the fact that he'd had experience of different cultures and that, you know, he could bring different points of view to everything that he came across. He'd clearly picked up quite a sense of the spirituality of the East, but he was not an obviously religious man.
Gods appear occasionally in his poems, but he wasn't especially religious.
It's interesting that he obviously, in India, he learnt about Hinduism and he rejected the multiplicity of gods. Part of his conservatism, if you like, was that he didn't want to stray off the straight and narrow path.
But, I mean, he was very hostile, for example, to spiritualism as well, which his sister, after her marriage ran into difficulties, his sister became very involved in spiritualism, his sister Trix, and Kipling warned her against it.
He was more attracted to Islam, I think, although obviously never followed it. I think he liked the rigour and the set of rules for practical life.
That is often said about English people in India or in the wider Islamic world. It's also a kind of literary conceit, I think, as much as anything, in that when he was in Lahore, he liked to read Persian poetry. You know, he found a lot of interest in, although he tried to learn Persian, so that he could read some of these poems in the original.
This is BBC Radio 4, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest this week, Sir John Major, has chosen Rudyard Kipling. Our expert witness is his biographer, Andrew Lycett. But before we bring him back from India, where his reputation has been, so to speak, anchored, just like to ask you to answer, Sir John, the charge that his attitude towards Indians and his attitude towards the idea that they might govern themselves or form political movements or become, in any sense of the word, westernised, that those attitudes were deeply reactionary.
Well, he was a Victorian man. You would have found, my father was a Victorian man, born 1879. And one of the few difficulties I ever had with my father was because he still retained certain Victorian attitudes. And that was very much an attitude of the time, and Kipling was it. It looks very bad today, very out of date. It is undoubtedly wrong. But he did have those attitudes, and they were widely held at the time.
He comes back from India, Andrew, still a very young man, but with already a pretty good literary reputation in India, of which people in Britain have begun to hear. How easily does he establish himself in England?
He found coming back to England very difficult, in fact. He missed the sunshine, the colour of India, and he found that life in England was not really what he expected, that people were rather mundane. He found the morals of people that he met rather loose, and he took against the emerging aesthetic movement. So he struggled a bit. He was looking to be popular and at the same time literary. I think that British letters at the time was in a state of flux past the days of Dickens and Thackeray, and we'd yet to get on to the kind of the Edwardians.
He wrote not just or even mainly for the appreciation or good opinion of his literary peers. He wrote for the public, and the public took to him at once, didn't they, Sir John? He caught the imagination.
Well, he caught the imagination before he came to England. And he came over as a young literary lion with a huge reputation in his early 20s. And he wasn't entirely unhappy. He also enjoyed going to Gatty's... I'm writing a book about music hall, and he used to enjoy going to Gatty's music hall.
Where was that?
Well, there were two Gatty's. There was Gatty's in the Strand and Gatty's under the arches. There were two of them. I'm not sure which one he went to. But he did write a music hall song for them as well, and actually went to the music hall to hear the audience roaring out the chorus. But he also had some difficulties. There was an old love of his called Flo Garrard, whom he met again in London, whom he was always obsessed with, and it wasn't reciprocated.
Was she his first
flame? Yes, I think
flame.
I think she was his first love, And when he, aged 16, went to India, he believed himself engaged to her. I'm not entirely sure why he believed that, but he appeared to do so. He wrote poems about her. He wrote a book about her. But she never reciprocated it. To the best of my knowledge, she never married. Kipling did marry. And so far as I know, it was a very happy marriage.
When, as I described it, he was having problems acclimatizing himself to being back in Britain, he was taken in hand by a curious figure, an American called Walcott Ballastier. Now, there was something about that relationship. It was very close. Kipling was introduced to Walcott's sisters. But what happened, in fact, was that Walcott died suddenly, and within a very short time, less than a month, people were talking about Kipling was going to marry Carrie, the rather more severe sister.
So his great friend Walcott dies. He comes back to Britain, tosses a coin, so to speak, and marries one of Walcott's sisters. Do you think it was Walcott he was really in love with, Sir John?
I don't think so.
It has been suggested.
I know it has. It's suggested about most people who are dead at some stage or another when people are beyond the laws of libel. But I've seen no sign anywhere that there was anything of that sort.
Except that he didn't seem to like women very much.
Do you not think?
Well, the female of the species is more deadly than the male. Lots of people, I think, wouldn't even know that that came from Kipling. It was in a pop song not very long ago. Pretty savage.
Yes, I think that was about a particular political campaign and women who were engaged in a campaign of which he disapproved.
He certainly had difficulties with women. I mean, he fell into marriage, and once he was married, he stuck with it. You know, it wasn't always easy as far as his relationship with his wife, Carrie, was concerned.
He was very struck when he came back to Britain at the way that in England, anyway, the problems of empire and the sacrifice being made for empire were little recognised.
He was concerned about what he saw as a lack of concern for the colonies. And that I think, was a view that grew with him through the 90s. After the turn of the century, I think many people think he saw the dangers of Germany, saw the Boer War as a rehearsal for a war that would come later. And that, of course, led him more into the view of the public as a man who was an imperialist and who was perhaps even a warmonger.
I'm struck, though, by a quite contradictory note, an extreme dislike, an angry irritability with hubris. For instance, for heathen, this is the poem Recessional, for heathen heart that puts her trust in reeking tube and iron shard, all valiant dust that builds on dust and guarding calls thee not to guard, for frantic boast and foolish word, thy mercy on thy people, Lord. He really doesn't like that kind of puffed up imperialism.
He wrote Recessional at the time of the Jubilee, when there was huge celebration. And the average mistaken view was that any Briton was worth any three foreigners. And I don't think Kipling, with his wider experience of the world, what do they know of England, who only England know, as he said, quite took that view. And I think his poem Recessional, from which you've just quoted, was an attempt to produce a bit of humility in the British and a bit of understanding that the world was a little different from the way they may view it at the time of Queen Victoria's celebrations. And it became a wonderful antidote to too much jingoism at the time, and I think was one of his greatest poems.
And yet, Sir John, when it came to the Boer War, he felt that Britain was not prosecuting that war with sufficient ferocity.
He did. He did think that. He was a great admirer of Cecil Rhodes, and he did actively help with that war.
And he was a lone voice at first, long before the First World War, exhorting Britain to prepare for that conflict too. He was quite prophetic in that respect.
He saw the Boer War as the first battle of the Great War. He saw the German support for Kruger as indicative of something awful in the German character. And he had a sort of visceral dislike for the Germans.
And then he lost his only son in the First World War.
His son Jack, yes, who was 18 when he was killed. Jack had very weak eyesight, and at first he couldn't get in the army. And there was Kipling, the arch-imperialist, And I dare say there was a lot of subliminal pressure on his son to join the army. And he did very early. He couldn't get in at first, and Kipling had to use his influence in order to get his son eventually into the war.
But he must have felt awful.
It is hard to imagine what life was like in that marriage after his son was killed.
And his remarks on the death of his son sound so cold that I can't believe they were anything but a distraught reaction. He says, oh, well, these things happen to us all.
But I think if you really wish to know his feelings, the poem My Boy Jack will give them to you.
Perhaps, Sir John, you'd just read a little.
Have you news of my boy Jack? Not this tide. When do you think that he'll come back? Not with this wind blowing and this tide. Has anyone else had word of him? Not this tide. For what is sunk will hardly swim. Not with this wind blowing and this tide.
Is this the end of Kipling? He lives on to 1936, but does he carry on producing memorable work?
He wrote quite a lot in the 1920s. Yes, indeed, he did.
I think that people are now rediscovering that later work and finding fine examples of the short story. And in fact, he's tackling interesting subject matter arising out of the Great War. He's writing about the effects of shell shock. He's writing about the bonds of friendship.
Can I put to you, Sir John, what George Orwell said? Kipling is almost a shameful pleasure, like the taste for cheap sweets that some people secretly carry into middle life. But even with his best passages, one has the same sense of being seduced by something spurious and yet unquestionably seduced.
I don't agree with Orwell. I can understand what he means, but I think he's wrong. Kipling is a poet who can bring tears to the eyes more readily than most. I don't think that is cheap. I think that unleashes emotions that lie underneath the surface that he was able to reach, and very few poets are. I turn to Kipling when I'm looking for something to be uplifting. I think it is uplifting, and in a range of ways, both in his short stories, which I think have such a sharp eye, but most of all, it's his poetry I love. So I'll reflect upon what Orwell said, but having reflected, I think it is very unlikely I'm going to agree with it.
Well, here to finish is something rather nice from Orwell. During five literary generations, says Orwell, every enlightened person has despised him, and at the end of that time, 9/10 of those enlightened persons are forgotten, and Kipling is in some sense still there.
People have been saying for 50 years or more that Kipling is just on the verge of coming back into fashion, and he somehow never quite becomes fashionable, but nevertheless remains right in the centre of people's observation and feelings.
My thanks to my guest on Great Lives, Sir John Major, and to our expert witness, Andrew Lycett. Goodbye.